Hello, dear friends. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. And as I start out this hour, I know this show is being released on Friday. Is that right, Amy? This goes out on Friday. And so I'm just going to make the final appeal about maybe there might be a ticket at Seattle Reality. I'm looking at the numbers here. We just had a handful of them, maybe 50 of them before, 52 on Tuesday. And chances are those are taken up, but maybe not. Sometimes people drop out. They say, okay, I'm in, I'm out. And that might leave an opening for you. Don't at all expect to show up and get in at the door. It's just not going to happen, all right? But you may want to sign up for that. We're looking at about 2,000 already for Minneapolis, St. Paul Reality. That's in 4 weeks. And that date is November 12th and 13th, and so wide open there. We're only half full, but we got a month to fill the rest up, and we've never had obviously that size before, 4,000. In fact, our largest was 2,700, Orange County 2019 before COVID hit, and then we got restricted. No restrictions now in Minneapolis. Our first time there was 2,500, something like that. The first time through, it was fabulous. And so no holds barred now. I hope you can make it to Minneapolis. Then we'll keep you updated with the dates in Dallas and Philly and Augusta in 2022. I had a magnificent time last Sunday teaching at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach, my church, for almost 25 years. And it was also a church that I had spent 8 years at as a staff pastor. They were the church that sent me out to start Stand to Reason along with Melinda Penner. We launched Stand to Reason in the Ocean View Room, and that was the very place that I taught on Sunday night. And they filled the room with chairs. It was about 115 or 120 chairs. They filled that all up. Then they had to expand out into the hallway with more chairs. I imagine there were close to 130, 140 people there. It was thrilling for me. Really satisfying. However, not a however, not a but in addition to that, afterwards, I had a chance to go out to dinner with Andrew, the fellow who runs the program, Hope Chapel Ministry Institute, that I was responsible for when I was there almost 30 years ago. And we got to talking, nice place. We finished the event supposedly 8 o'clock. I didn't get out of there till 9:15. People were fabulous. And I finally squeezed out and drove down to the local restaurant that was still open. It was a nice place, and we were having dinner. They were treating me. And got in a conversation with the waitress. And this is one of those conversations I just wish could have been recorded, all right? And the reason is not because I was so clever, I was so smart, I did such a great job, or anything. I didn't even talk to this young lady about the gospel. But I took opportunity to do some gardening, which I had just been talking about. And you know I've talked about that a lot. And if you read the material for Stand to Reason, you know this is central. That in order to use the tactical game plan most effectively, it requires an adjustment in our thinking so that we are not in harvest mode, but we are in gardening mode. Because without gardening, there's no harvest. Okay, that's the idea. And I'm pretty convinced that when the harvest is ripe in any individual's life, the fruit falls into the basket. Boom, just like that. The key is getting the gardening done. And the gardening is a team effort. And so we have a big team. And if we all do a little bit of the gardening, given that we have tools to do that, and that's the tactical game plan, then there's going to be a bigger harvest. That's the mentality. Trying to get people off the bench who are afraid of trying to harvest fruit that's not ripe. Trying to, you know, jerk the fruit off the vine when it's not ready. And that doesn't work, so they're going to sit on the bench and not be involved at all. And my project is to get them off the bench, into play, into the garden, doing some gardening with the game plan. But when you have even 2 hours, which is what I had, and I had about 15 minutes of Q&A, but even an hour and 45 minutes of talk time, it's still so inadequate to cover the bases and try to give people a real sense of things. This is why I want them to buy the book, so they can look at how I play it out in more detail there and how I, and all the illustrations from actual encounters that I have. And I even apologized. I said, you know, I feel ill-equipped, even after all the times I've given this talk to them, to people, to convey to them a clear sense of how useful the tactical approach is, particularly the Columbo game plan, and how easy it is. And characteristically, what I say is, hey, just commit yourself to talking to people about their own ideas about spiritual things and just drawing them out with some form of the question, what do you mean by that? Now, don't ask the question in a wooden way. There are gazillions of variations that you're essentially asking for more clarification of the other person's point of view or background or whatever it is that you're talking about. And if you just go out and just do that one step, you will be surprised at how much God will do. And I gave some illustrations from my own life. And one of those was a Seattle, a waitress in Seattle about not quite 2 years ago when I was coming out of my hotel on a Sunday morning, coming into the restaurant early on my way eventually to preach at a church, and I was not quite awake, and I'm not a morning person, and I just wanted my coffee, and I didn't want to witness. But here's this gal, and I couldn't help myself, to be honest with you. I won't give you the whole story, but the point is, even just making the first effort to draw somebody else and ask their views and clarification of their views has an impact. The Holy Spirit can use that. But even if the Holy Spirit doesn't use it because you don't get anywhere, at least you have stepped into the pool in the shallow end to see, you know, the to test the water, so to speak. All right. In this particular case, that night, Sunday night at dinner, we did not go anywhere spiritually significant. So there is no testimony here. There's no, and then she said, wow, I never heard anything like that. I'll have to think about Jesus or anything like that. We didn't even talk about Jesus. What it was, though, to me, is a textbook example of probing with the game plan in an amicable way, getting the other person to respond, to give lots of information that was pertinent to her and her views, without offending her, without bothering her, in a very relaxed environment, and having an opportunity to put a very small stone in her shoe, which I took the opportunity, whether the stone went in or not, that is, whether what I said affected her or not, I don't know. And most, obviously, most of the times you don't know that. You do what you can do before the Lord, and you let the Lord worry about it because it's his problem, not ours. It's our task in that moment, but not our problem. But I, this is where I wish that whole thing, I had a GoPro, you know, and the whole scene could have been made available to everybody that I taught that evening and all of you to watch. Because when I was done, Andrew, the pastor who was taking me out to dinner, he said, boy, that's just a perfect example of what you were talking about tonight. And it was easy and it went nicely and it was great. And that's what I would like you to see. You see, the way we got into this, so we're there at the table. She's our waitress, right? And her name, a standard thing I do as an ambassador, is ask the name of the waiter or waitress. Why? Well, then you can address them more personally. It's more friendly. If you need them, you can call to them, you know, in a polite way, but by their name, and it's just a lot more convenient. But it does create a nicer atmosphere. Sometimes when I ask for the name of a waiter or waitress, they'll say, I'm, you know, Fred or whatever, and what's yours? And I could give them my name. Then, so there's something nice that happens there, and that's always good. Even if you don't get to spiritual things, that's good, that's friendly, that's nice, and if you do move ahead, you've got a leg up a little bit, all right? It turned out that her name was Suray. Suray. Now, that's not English, American, and she was darker skinned. She looked Middle Eastern to me. And so I asked her, I said, do you mind if I ask you a question about your name? And nowadays, it might be a good idea to take that initial step because sometimes people might get offended if you draw some attention to their ethnicity. So I asked her about it, and she said it was Turkish. She said, my dad is Turkish, and my mom is from Romania. Now, I know in Turkey, it's almost all Islamic. There are Christians there, but predominantly Islamic. But in Romania, it's not just Islamic, it's also Christian, all right? In fact, I was there in 1976 in different cities in Romania, Cluj, for example, and also Bucharest, working with Christians and meeting with Christians who were suffering persecution back when that was behind the Iron Curtain. So I was able to say, yeah, I was there before, and I've been actually a couple of times to Romania, so we could kind of make common cause there a little bit. But then I asked her, so if your dad's from Turkey, would that make you Muslim? Now notice that now I've just crossed the bridge into a religious discussion, but it was effortless, and we were all relaxed, and I was showing a genuine interest in this sweet young lady, and it was no speed bump, never hit a hitch to ask her about her religious upbringing. And she said, well, her dad is Turkish, and Islam, and she made, but we're not really strict. Well, I wasn't sure what that meant. I could presume what it meant, but see, do you realize here's another opportunity for me to say, well, what do you mean by that? Okay, now I didn't use that phrase, but I did ask that kind of question. So when you say you're strict, does that mean you don't, you know, go to services on a regular basis, you don't pray, or how does that work? What does that look like? And so she explained it, okay, which is fine. She's happy doing it. And then I said, are those your personal convictions? Are you Muslim? And she said, well, and then she begged off a little bit there. And then she said, look, I know Jews and I know Christians and I know Muslims. And who's to say who's right? Who's to say who's right? This is what she said. I wasn't there. She makes this comment a couple of times. I wasn't there. So now I'm getting a little sense of what her epistemology is. How do you know what you know when it comes to religion? Well, I wasn't there, so you can't know. But that helps me. Now I've got a piece of information that will allow me to maneuver. Plus, in her comments, it was clear that she is being sensitive to being dogmatic about her views. I have friends who are Christians. I have friends that are Jewish. I have friends who are Muslims. So now she's not going to rock the boat. Okay, so now I'm aware that she has this little sensitivity. By the way, do you think any of these things that I'm picking up on because I'm paying attention, asking these questions, drawing her out, are important for me to know how to navigate next? Yes, exactly. That's the point. So I'm not going to come in full bore, blasting away, because she'll say, wait a minute, who can know? And anyway, I don't want to rock the boat. I don't want to make people mad at me, kind of thing. Well, I pick that up so that, what's the right word here? That informed the way that I continued in the conversation. And I don't know how this change happened in this, but she was saying something about the traveling to Turkey and that nobody in Turkey believes in the Armenian Holocaust, those millions of Armenians that were sacrificed during that period of time, I think in the 19th century, 20th century. And this, of course, Turks were the ones who were responsible for that. All right. Now, in Turkey, nobody believes that, she said. But I know that it happened. Oh, did you hear that? Now she knows something from the past where she wasn't at. She wasn't there. And she thinks she's drawn an accurate conclusion about something that is controversial and even denied by a massive number of people, a whole country of people, the Turks. But she's convinced it happened. And so this is where I just very gently, I said, so I guess you can. So in other words, you're saying you can know some things about the past if you have enough good evidence to conclude that, something to that effect. And she said, well, yeah, I can. Well, she just displayed that. All I was doing was pointing it out. There's a little epistemological switch. She went from, I wasn't there, religion, I don't know what happened, religion, therefore, I can't say what happened. Okay? Two, I wasn't there, and a lot of people say it didn't happen, but I know enough to say that it did happen. Okay, that is a shift in epistemology, how she knows what she knows. And by the way, this is a very common notion. There's nothing controversial about that. We all believe that. We all believe you can know things about things that happen when you weren't there if there's adequate evidence for it. This is very, very common. But people balk when it comes to religious questions, and they don't want to apply the same kind of rules that would properly, it seems to me, apply even to spiritual questions. And certainly with regards to Christianity, because we do make appeal to evidence that has to do with history about events that happened in history, all right? Now, I had those pieces in place there because I had asked the questions and I drew her out, and it was totally amicable. And there was no stress or strain of any kind, but she had already revealed a whole bunch of stuff about herself and about her spiritual frame of mind. This is golden for me. Well, here is the problem. She's a waitress at our table. So there's no opportunity for a real extended conversation in a situation like that because she's got a job to do. And in fact, I think we were there fairly late, so they're kind of getting close to closing down. There wasn't a real demand on her. So it gave us a little bit more flexibility to interact and to chat together. But I, at the same time, I realized that I could not pursue this communication realistically any further with her, and probably. And so I was just willing to let the conversation die a natural death. Now, this is a circumstance where I employed the game plan very simply, the very first step, carefully and graciously and genuinely, authentically drawing another person out, sharing an interest in there, and it's able to blend into a flow into a spiritual conversation of sorts about religion. I'm able to get a little sense of her sensitivities and also make a point, that small pebble in that case, that, well, you can know some things that you didn't see when you weren't there if you have good reason to believe them. Is that right? Yes, it is. So that was something that I would have worked with if I were able to meet with her again, if she was a friend that I had another opportunity to talk with, or if I came back to this restaurant on a regular basis, which I'm not going to do because it's a long way away and it's really expensive. So it's out of my ken financially. I was glad I was being treated. But that's how this often works. Why was this successful? I didn't talk about the gospel. I didn't get into Christianity. It's successful in the sense that I employed my game plan, and I was able to test the waters and see how far I can get in the limited time I had to possibly, potentially make a difference. And as it turned out, I don't know that I made a big difference. We didn't get very far. The circumstances didn't allow that, but I didn't find that out until I started probing with my game plan. And that's what I want you to do. Take the opportunities that are before you and ask some simple questions. Draw the person out. And if you have an opportunity there to somehow, based on the circumstances, to shift into spiritual things or religious things or something like that, fine. You know, then take that with a simple question and show interest in the other person. And then see where it goes. One of the reasons this is safe, actually, there's a couple here. One of them is you're going in, just like I was doing, into the shallow end of the pool, testing the water. Nothing about me or my views was on the line. I wasn't making any assertions at that point. I wasn't making any claims for my views. I was laying the ground, maybe for the future, to do that. But at this point, I hadn't. So I had no burden of proof. I had nothing to defend. I wasn't pushing. I was drawing her out. Okay. The other thing about these kinds of questions is if I ever felt uncomfortable for whatever reason, I have an easy back door. It's right there. I just stop asking the questions. There's nothing on the line. Now, I'm not saying this so that you can take the back door. That's not my advice. I'm saying this for people who are thinking, I don't even have enough boldness to take those first steps. And I'm saying, never mind. If you run out of steam, if you run out of courage, if it doesn't go the way you want it to go, fine. Just stop asking questions. Go on with your meal or whatever. You don't have to keep going forward. You can stop anytime you want. But I have a sense that once you get started a little bit, you're going to realize, well, the water's kind of warm here. It's not like chili. it's not so bad. And then you're going to move a little deeper and deeper and deeper if there's a receptive party. And if not, you just let the conversation die a natural death and you move on. But you are taking opportunity that's given to you and seeing if you can make something out of it without making a fuss, without causing any damage, and without bruising the fruit. And that is one of the huge benefits of using the tactical game plan. All right, that was Sunday. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back for our calls here on Stand to Reason.
Do you want to become a more knowledgeable Christian ambassador without sitting through a formal course on apologetics? Well, we've made that possible for you through our STR Quick Reference app. Available for free on iTunes and Google Play, the STR Quick Reference app holds a wealth of information summarizing what you need to know on a range of topics. Learn how to defend the faith, see how other worldviews compare to Christianity, and master the biblical view of morality, all through short, engaging videos. Before you know it, you'll be well-versed on a number of important apologetics topics. In addition, the Quick Reference app also includes a Bible with text and audio, as well as some featured STR resources, all to enhance your learning experience. The STR Quick Reference app will equip you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the key issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Visit iTunes or the Google Play Store today and download the STR Quick Reference app. And if you enjoy the app, make sure you give it a 5-star review.
When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group, helping STR-trained Christians to confidently and graciously defend their convictions. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our ongoing work. As our thanks for your partnership, we have created some benefits to express our gratitude, like a 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and more. To become a strategic partner, visit str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email Ocean Wilson at ocean@str.org.
Is that my cue?
Okay.
Thank you, Kyle. Greg Kochel here, back with you, giving you a piece of my mind. And I realize, you know, 30 years plus counting, 31 or something like that, I don't always give you just a piece of my mind. I give you a piece of my heart, too. That's right. Isn't that sweet? You're getting a piece of me. All right. Let's go to Jordan in Georgia. And thank you for waiting all through that full first hour with Mr. J. Warner Wallace. You've been very patient, Jordan.
Thank you. It's not a problem. How you doing, Greg?
Okay. Nice to hear from you. What's up?
I have a question regarding the nature of idolatry and exactly what it is and what it isn't, because I've heard a lot of things from people. They want to say what it is, and then I'm kind of unsure about it. Mm-hmm. I just want to get things correct and stuff, because I know that in church this past Sunday, we were actually going over a Colossians 3:5. It says, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Mm-hmm. And coupled with that, just these are some things I've heard as to what some people consider is idolatry. And to me, I just don't think it's necessarily good to think in the way that they're thinking. One of the things I've heard especially is anything that you spend more time with than God is idolatry, which I think is a little bit dangerous thinking, simply because if that's the case, then for most human beings, eating, sleeping, and working would also be idols.
So. That's right. Yeah, I think that is a bit extreme. I'm with you there. Although the Colossians passage, what passage was it specifically? Colossians what?
Colossians 3:5.
I'm just turning there now because it does point out that there can be a kind of an idolatrous focus on things that normally people would not think of as idols. So it seems to be a little bit more expansive than just a thing like this, what do you call it, the visage or this thing. I'm holding my water bottle right now because I'm trying to, materialized my idol right here. But a thing, an object, I think people think initially that's what is in view there. And I think that is part of it, but it goes beyond that. Consider your members of your earthly body dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. Now, it looks to me, as just as I go over that, verse 5, that the thing that is idolatry identified by Paul is the greed, not necessarily every one of those things. All right? Because I think all those other things fall in a little bit different category. And greed, which amounts to idolatry, is what he's saying. So the phrase which amounts to idolatry, my natural instinct in reading the section would be to take it as referring to the greed, not necessarily everything else. Now, that doesn't mean the everything else is just fine, but I don't think he's saying that all these things are idolatry. I think that idolatry, and to put it in its most general sense, is worshiping something that is not God. All right? So that's idolatry. And it could be the sun. You're worshiping the sun. Or it could be worshiping some man-made artifact. Isaiah makes fun of idolaters. They say they take the wood and you carve the wood. You throw half of the wood in the fire and you burn it. The other one, you carve a face in it. And it has ears and it can't hear. And it has eyes it can't see. And it has a mouth and it can't speak. And those who trust them are like them, something to that effect. So he's mocking them. So idolatry takes on these different forms. And I actually think that idolatry can happen when you have an object of veneration, and the object is the focus of your veneration, even though the thing you're venerating might be a genuine or true thing. So if you're worshiping the true God and you make an image of the true God to worship the image, to worship the true God through, all right, that's idolatry. The reason I make this distinction is it isn't that you just got God wrong. It's that you've got worshiping God wrong. And what God says is don't, in the Mosaic law, don't make an image of anything, including me, because there's danger of falling into, that's an example of idolatry, and he's saying not to do that because of the consequence of doing that, okay? So I think it covers both things. So there's very general. It is worshiping something that is not God, or worshiping God through something that is a physical object, all right? And that covers a little bit more ground, I think, for Christians nowadays. Most people in general, we don't have like a lot of sun worshipers here. Strictly speaking, sun worshipers, you're a god, I'm worshiping him. And they show up on the beach, but we don't mean that when we say they're the sun worshipers worshiping the sun god, you know. But though there may be some pagan types that do that kind of thing. But there are objects of veneration that people sometimes have that function as idols. And then I think they're in violation of the command against idolatry when they do that. And that seems to me pretty straightforward from the Old Testament prohibitions of making images, particularly for that purpose. In Colossians, we see it expanded a little bit more in what Paul is saying, that at least when it comes to greed, there is a sense in which when you are overcome with fleshly greed, you are treating money like a god. That becomes the central focus of your life. And that is what you're living for and not God. All right? And so I think there's probably more things than greed that would fall into that category. But I don't think everything that distracts you from full devotion of God to God is going to be is legitimately called an idol in this sense. I mean, we have relationships, right? And when I'm, you know, with my family, I'm not always thinking about God, thinking about those relationships. When I'm fishing, all right, I'm not thinking about God. I'm thinking about fishing. But that doesn't mean that fishing is an idol. Could fishing become an idol when it becomes the center of my life and dethrones God? Yes, it could be, after a fashion. I think that's possible. But I don't think anything like what you just described is a fair characterization of idolatry. If anything that takes up more time in your life than God does, how much time does God take up in our lives? What does that even look like? When you're praying, that's time with God, yeah. But when you're not praying, I mean, that's not time with God. There's a sense in which I think we are to be, as the Latin puts it, coram Deo, that we are before the God, before God all the time, C-O-R-A-M-D-E-O, or Deum, something like that. Coram Deo, before God. And so that's our whole lives. So I think that can be overdone. But I do think that there are times when we have other things become such a focus that they push God out of the equation almost entirely. I think sex becomes a god for some people. I think fame becomes a god for some people. Certainly money, which is what he's referring to here. I don't know, does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying, Greg. I was just very curious as to your input there, and just because I've heard the whole thing about the time being a factor, and I always thought that was strange because of the sort of contradictory nature of that. And the idea, plus, I mean, I kind of view God as timeless, so I think the amount of time you spend with God is a little less important than the quality of the time you spend with him. Like, as you said, I think we're kind of always in the presence of the Lord and kind of always,
right.
And there's so many different ways to worship right. him too, and you know.
Yeah, and whether or not God is timeless, we are in time, and so we time is a zero-sum game, so we can spend so much here and that takes away from elsewhere. And if we're not spending any time with God, it's hard for me to think that someone can be before God on a consistent basis without having a diet of time with God as part of that time before God. So the way I was putting it is I want to be intimate with God and connect with God, and I have a pattern of things that helps me to do that, reading the Word. I mean, principally, reading the Word, maybe worshiping, and prayer, that all helps me. But these are things, the prayer is things I do through the day, and even if I'm not praying or worshiping, but there is a sense that I am before the Lord or in the presence of God, and that is, after a fashion, spending time with God, but my focus is different. It's like you and I could go to a movie together, right? And so we're together, but our focus is elsewhere, even though we're hanging out. And sometimes, I mean, that's, I think, the sense of the presence of God. You know, practicing the presence of God, I think that's the way it works out for me, at least, much of the time. Awareness of God being here with me and that I am before him in all I do.
And so would you consider then the idolatry of ancient times equivalent to the idolatry of today, as in making a graven image and then worshiping it? Because I don't think a lot of people actually do that today. I mean, you mentioned pagans, they would probably do that, but as a modern trope, I don't really see that a lot of the time.
No, not the graven images. That was more the habit of the religious people of the ancient Near East, the graven image. And actually, that's a good phrase, graven image. I was looking for something like that when I'm holding up my water bottle here. Okay, there it is, the graven image. but I don't think people do that so much. I think they are other non-physical substitutes. I do think this happens. I think there are religious traditions that use physical objects as vehicles for veneration. I think it gets out of hand. Okay, that's as far as I'm going to go with that for now. But I think characteristically you're correct that some other non-physical thing becomes the object of practical veneration and the center of our life. The warning here in Colossians is to greed. But it also makes a statement about immorality and impurity, and I don't know that maybe Paul is talking about all of those things, evil desire, all of these being an idolatry and not just greed. But certainly, even if Paul means greed in this verse, it certainly can be the case where there are, I mean, this to me is obvious that people have made an idol out of sex, and this is what drives them. I think what people who have sexual identity, whose identity is based on sex, who have adopted an identity that is tied to their sexual appetites. Now, think about that for a moment. I said it in a very specific way instead of just saying gay people. Because what a gay person is, and the LGBT crowd and all of that, are people who have established an identity, their word, based on their sexual appetite. And the first time I heard this referred to this way was by Christopher Ewan, and he's spoken for us a number of times, coming out of that lifestyle. And it was the first time when he brought this up, I thought, yeah, that's weird. Why would somebody want to base their identity on their sexual appetite. And that's, even though we're used to the notion because we're socialized by our culture, when you put it that way, it does seem a little bit strange. Instead of having what I have my identity based on my love for Mexican food, I'm a Mexican food lover. That's where my identity is. I mean, see, that sounds silly, but people do it with their sexual appetites, not their physical appetites. And that, I think, is strange. And it strikes me that that is an example of something peripheral being brought into the center of the life that is the defining feature of that individual. And that isn't God, nor one's relationship with God. Under that circumstance, I think the word idolatry might properly apply.
It's a good, I've never thought of it that way before. That's very interesting. Mm. I mean, that's all really uneasy, Greg. I appreciate your input, and I just wanted to get some advice about that and making sure I understand what idolatry is and what it isn't, because I want to make sure I'm not having any idols or having anything like that in my life. So.
Well, I'm sure you're doing fine, but I appreciate the call, Jordan, and just that you're concerned about it and looking here, trying to discern what the right understanding is, so that you can not be an idolater. That's a good sign. So good for you, okay?
Thank you, Greg. God bless you, brother.
Oh, thank you a lot. Bye, Jordan.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's go to break. Is that all right with you, Kyle? All right, and then I'll wait for Kyle's signal, and I'll come back in. Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love #STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. #STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, #STRAsk. That's #STRAsk.
The world says you can be a boy or a girl. You can be gay or straight. You can be cis or trans. There's no right or wrong way to define yourself. No one can tell you who you are. You decide who you want to be, and whatever that is, it can change whenever you want. That's because your identity is untethered to reality. It's chaos. But you don't have to listen to the world. You can listen to a different account of who you are, one told by your maker. And this one is anchored to reality and will bring you from chaos to clarity. Don't miss this year's Reality Conference. Go to realityapologetics.com to get dates and locations for the Student Apologetics event of the year.
All righty, Greg Kokel here. Show is Stand to Reason. That's Kyle on the bongos there. All right. You know, I had an interview a while back, series of questions, and on occasion they'll send me the questions, and normally, to be honest, that's okay if they don't. I don't really need them. It isn't like I think about them and I got to ponder how I'm going to answer. I'm usually just kind of answer, particularly when they're autobiographical. But this series of questions struck me as something that might have to do with information you might be interested in. And I do get this question a lot. Doing what I do, before we get into the material of the interview, say tactics or relativism, a story of reality, whatever it happens to be, they ask me, how did you come to know the Lord? How did you get into apologetics? And I've talked about my own testimony with you before, but that particular question is a fair one. And some people, like J. Warner Wallace, who we had on in the last show, and Frank Turek, and John Noyes from our own team, and apologetics significantly, it played a significant part in them becoming Christians. This was not the case for me. most of the people that I know who are colleagues who do this, that's the circumstance, and that's how they got into apologetics, because they got into it before they became Christians. But not me. I don't know how else to explain what happened to me, except for that I had an increasing conviction that Christianity was true. The claims of Jesus were true. He was who he claimed to be. And that he had a legitimate claim on my life. And so September 28th, 1973, a little more than 48 years ago, that's when I gave my life to Christ, and everything took off from there. I mentioned the other night when I was at Hope Chapel that I don't like the idea that just the whole notion of deciding for, I'm not interested really in decisions for Christ. I am interested in conversions, not decisions. But what I usually invite people to do is to follow Jesus. Now, I don't mean this as a works thing, like try to do what he did and be as good as he was. I mean that people should follow him. They should they put their trust in him and follow. So this is a real conversion, creates followers, not just people who made a decision for Jesus at some time in the past. I make a distinction there, because there are a lot of decisions, and some people have decided more than once, and they want conversions for whatever reason. I want followers, okay? And this is what I began to do. I did make a decision. I have a spiritual birthday, but I began to follow, and that's what mattered. My sense is the night that I told my brother that I wanted to become a Christian, I probably already was one. I probably already was believing that Jesus is the Messiah. And that evening, I just, tightened it up a bit. I confessed with my mouth, Jesus is Lord, kind of thing. But after that, when I started engaging people on the street of Westwood Village right by UCLA in the fall of 73 and in the beginnings of 74, I'd walk the streets, and hang out and get something to eat and mix with the people. And it was a very fab, popular place to be. Did I just say fab? I said fab. What I mean by fab is like groovy. I guess that word's just as bad. But so lots of folks there is a happening scene, right? And so you can get into conversations because there are lots of religious trips doing their thing on the sidewalks, peddling their wares. And so I got into a lot of conversations with people. But I realized very quickly that my knowledge was not adequate to the task. And that's what drove me a little bit to apologetics, and the fact that I think my mind is bent that way a bit. It's my disposition, even though it wasn't a factor in me becoming a Christian. And this is when I discovered Francis Schaeffer and Josh McDowell and C.S. Lewis probably then as well. And the one that stands out for me most, I did like Josh's stuff, but Francis Schaeffer stood out for me most and had the biggest impact on me. In 1976, I was able to visit La Brie there in the little village of Huemo up in Switzerland there. And I'd been reading and following and got to meet him. And so he's had a great impact on my life, his writing, although I didn't know him, met him once. But this is began to form my thinking. Okay. And I had no mentor in apologetics per se, but I was in a community. I did have a mentor, Craig Englert, but I was in a community that took the Life of the Mind seriously. This place was called the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse. Sounds kind of corny when I say it now. We just called it the Light and Powerhouse, or the house. But this was an old fraternity house right off the campus of UCLA that was converted to a Christian training school and a community. There was probably 75 to 80 men and women in different sections of the house that lived there. And I was one of them. And there was, about 15 or 20 or 25 or 30, whatever, living off campus. We had great teaching, great opportunities to get on the street and make a difference for Christ. And that was how I got my launch. All right. Now, I was also asked in this interview, this is how I got involved there. And they asked, what was the culture like when I got started? And the culture, to be honest with you, is rather tame by today's standards. It just was. I don't know how else, almost bland by today's standards. But today, the worldview is very different. And I actually think, now that I think about it, the worldview today, and that was one question that I was asked, by contrast, the worldview today, I think, is split. And it's split because human beings live in two worlds. They live, on the one hand, in the world of their philosophy, whatever philosophy it is they cling to, and I'll describe what I think that is for the vast majority of Americans right now. And they also live in the world that God made. Now, if you've read the tactics book of the 10th anniversary edition, you know there's a tactic called Inside Out, and I trade on this distinction here. And this is something I got from Francis Schaeffer. Every human being is made in the image of God. That's a matter of fact. And they have to live in the world that God has made. And therefore, if they deny God or deny the God of described in scriptures, then they have to deny something about reality. Certainly denying God is denying reality. And they have to deny the other things in reality that are connected to God. And now this is a thing that a lot of people don't understand. And I'll see if I can explain it here in just a few moments. Worldviews are packages. Okay? They're not just individual things. It isn't just like, well, I'm a Christian, and that's just like one thing. Being a Christian entails believing in a number of things that are part of the package. And I don't just mean the deity of Christ or Jesus rose from the dead. Certainly those things. I'm talking about things that are more metaphysical, not historical. All right? And so that if there is a God, and that's the number one question anybody has to answer because it affects everything else. If there is a God, there's a whole bunch of other parts of a worldview that attach naturally to that piece. For example, if there is a God, then maybe God has an opinion about how we live. And that means morality is out there, objective, not in here, subjective, just up to me. It's out there. What's right or wrong is not up to my own personal opinion. Someone else who is in a position of authority over the universe has made decisions about that one way or another. It's grounded one way or another in that individual. Okay, so if you got God, you got at least the possibility of morality, objective morality. Watch this. If you don't have God, you don't have objective morality because there is no external standard. That standard, by the way, that's going to make sense, and this is takes a little bit of philosophical footwork here, but what it amounts to, if there is no God, there can't be a morality, not objective, not one that we are beholden to. The essence of morality is obligation, and we are not obliged to principles. We are obliged to people. The only reason we have to drive 35 miles an hour in a school zone or whatever, that's too fast, isn't it? Is not because the sign says 35, not because there's a rule that just hangs out there, but rather there is an authority that is appropriately requiring us and then alerts us to the requirement with the sign. If there is no authority, you don't have to obey any of the signs, all right? You get that? That's pretty straightforward, all right? If I put the sign out, they don't have to obey it. I'm not the proper authority. Without God, no morality. No morality, no rights. Really? You know what a right is? It's an obligation someone has to you regarding something. It's a just claim to something. I have this right. When I say I have this right, that built into that claim is the moral obligation that you have to affirm the right and give me what my right gives me. Provides for me, entitles me to. But if there is no morality, there can't be any entitlements that are morally sound. There can't be any rights. Rights are tied to morality. Morality is tied to God. No God, no morality. No morality, no rights. That's part of the package. That's all I'm saying. So when you make the case that God exists or that he doesn't, there are going to be consequences for the details. All right? Now, back to the original question, and the question has to do about today's culture. Our culture is split. I think the predominant conscious ethic is, simply put, you do you. Right? It's all about the individual. I get what I want when I want it. All right? narcissism, self-love. And that means what's right or wrong for any given individual is tied to how the thing in question serves what they want. That's a right or wrong that's on the inside of them, making it relativistic, subjectivistic, not on the outside of them, making it objective. They don't want the objective thing because the objective thing might tell them no for what they want to do. They don't want to be told no. They want to be told yes. And they think then all I have to do is tell myself yes, and that's all that's necessary. Now, you can go that way if you want. Maybe that is the way the world is structured, but it can only be structured that way if there either is no God or the God that exists is not moral and makes no obligations on anyone. Maybe there's some people who like that idea. It seems unlikely to me that that's the case. But in any event, if you're going to just say, no God, I get to do what I want, guess what? So does everybody else. And this is where relativism ends up self-destructing in practical terms, because you cannot have a community in which human beings flourish when each of them gets to do whatever they want. They are operating according to their own moral code. Now, some people want to abbreviate that, or should say adjust it, so it doesn't sound so stark, and say, well, I can do whatever I want as long as it's not hurting someone. That's called the minimalist ethic. The problem is, and there's many of them, is that it's too minimal. That says, first of all, you are asserting an objective moral standard. It's the harm standard. You can do what you want unless you harm somebody. Okay, my response is going to be, who says who? Who is the one that makes the obligation on us not to harm others? Because if that individual who's in a position of authority to do that, ultimate authority, I mean, that would be God, it might be that he's got a couple more rules than just that one. Maybe you also have an obligation not just to not do harm, but to do good. Okay? That's another side of it. The harm principle just says you can't hurt somebody. It doesn't oblige you to do good to anybody, but most people think that that's the right thing, that we should be doing good to others as well. So the minimalist ethic is not, it's just too minimal. Plus, who knows what is going to harm people in the long run? That's another question. I'm not hurting anybody. Doesn't seem like that at the moment, but wait a while, we'll see what happens. This is where the wisdom of the ages comes in, because we learn the consequences of foolish activity, and we can point the foolishness out even when it doesn't seem harmful. We know that it works out that way, so we say no to that. People want to push against that. What I'm saying here now is that we live in a culture, though, that is caught between two worlds. They want to do their own thing, but they feel very comfortable kind of trying to grab a little moral ethic here and insert it in a way that gives them the freedom to keep doing mostly what they want. Everything that they don't think in the present moment harms anyone in a meaningful way. They're all kind of qualifiers. So what they're doing is they're trying to advance their own relativism. At the same time, they're hanging on to something, an objective moral standard that doesn't have any place in their worldview. Why are they doing that? And here's why. Because, as Francis Schaeffer pointed out, we actually are human beings made in the image of God. So the modern people are split, or you can even call them postmodern if you want to. On the one hand, they are trying to operate autonomously. On the other hand, they don't want you to operate autonomously towards them. That ain't right. You can't do that. It hurts me. It steps on my toes. It violates my rights, on and on and on. But notice that all of these are moral statements, judgments that have no place in their worldview if they're relativists. So I think that modern people are split. This gives us an opportunity. I explain this in the tactics book in that chapter on the inside out. And the point there is that there are things that God has placed inside of us, being made in the image of God, that don't stay inside. We can blather on about false ideologies that we embrace, yet the truth that is on the inside eventually comes on the outside. It comes from the inside to the outside. And our approach then is to watch for that when it happens. Listen to the language. Pay attention. So when Richard Dawkins says that this world is the kind of world that would be real if there was no God, there's no good, there's no evil, there's nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Okay, now he's talking like an atheist. All right, he's welcome to that. Because if his worldview is true, this is an accurate statement. No good, no bad, no evil, nothing virtuous, nothing, no vice, not really. Nothing but, and then another application here, morality's gone, so is meaning. Meaning, and someone there who cares, blind, pitiless indifference. Oh, good, that's his atheism. I'm with him there. That makes sense. But then when he writes in another book, The God Delusion, how evil the God of the Old Testament is, a bully, a homophobe, a masochist, and on he goes. Wait, where is he getting that language? He's not getting it from his atheism. That language is coming from somewhere else, deep down inside him. He is a common sense moral realist. He realizes there are genuine moral categories. Now, I think he's misapplying them when it comes to God in the Old Testament. But nevertheless, he is not speaking like an atheist when he says that. He's speaking like someone speaking like a theist, but I got to qualify it. He's speaking like someone who needs to trade on a theistic worldview to get the moral categories that he needs to condemn God in the theistic worldview, at least the biblical God. So there you got the perfect iteration of the split personality. And that, I think, is the modern, or if you will, the postmodern mentality. Something to think about. All right, that's it for the show, friends. Thank you so much for being a part of it. I'll be back next week, same time, same station. Greg Kuchel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.